nearing that 30-year limit they started, what, 1981 there. I remember the first flight was a big white tank, and then they just go. So yeah, that's pretty much gone the way of the bronze. Remember the bronze, Dick? Official name. The Russian tank.
Understand, Paul. Okay, I believe you. That's the end of the space shuttle. Okay, the next person on the list was John. I know that you had a question. KC2WGB. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, did you hear my question? Did you remember the bronze by the Russians?
No, I don't think I did. The bronze by the Russians. Give us a couple words on that one, Paul.
Because I see my signal dropping, so I thought maybe... okay, I thought maybe you didn't hear it. The bronze was the... I believe you can convert that name to Snowbird. I think it was something of that nature. This was the sign for us. The Gina rocket, big freaking rocket, and they launched this thing out of space with no people on it, and it came back and landed, and that was a wrap. I mean, they were going to have astronauts and the whole program built around this thing. I think they saw the cost was just so phenomenal, they dropped it like a hot potato, and they put it out in a field somewhere where it rusted and rotted it. Kids were throwing rocks at it back to you.
As a last question, Paul, did that Russian spacecraft resemble the International Space Shuttle? Is that part of why they gave it up? Because we came to the conclusion it's dangerous and expensive, and that theirs, was it sort of a copy of the Space Shuttle, or was it an entirely different looking craft? Back to you for a final on that one, Paul.
Yeah, I've got books on it, pictures of it. It looks exactly like it. And it's mounted to a gigantic tank, very similar to the external tank. And instead of with solid boosters, it had like liquid boosters attached to it. This thing was huge. It was similar to ours, and it looked like about the same size, and it looked very similar design. And I've never heard anybody say that the Russians stole the blueprint, but it sure looked that way.
I hear you. Yeah, the Russians, they did have a version that looked like the B-1 bomber. They had a version of the space shuttle that looked a little bit like ours. So sometimes those good designs are worth copying. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead with your question, John. K2LIW in the tech man.
KC2WGB. A quick question for Paul before I start mine. Isn't it true we gave away all the airframes to museums and things? I don't think we have any left, do we?
I guess I have it. All the shuttles went to different locations. One to Florida, one to the Smithsonian. Where were the other two? I don't know. I didn't keep track. I don't care where they wind up. I should. I think I put one in New York. Somebody interrupted. I know they had a bid out for it, but if I ever wanted to go visit one, I should find out where they all wound up there. But yeah, it's on the internet where they, you know, they're not going to rip them apart. They're not going to let them rot like the Russians did. They'll take care of them. I mean, they took a lot of the guts apart and made it safe. You know, there's a lot of tanks and fuel tanks and stuff. They took a lot of stuff out of it, but the fact is, one this, I think it was this weekend, supposed to be today, that they were going to fly over Washington, D.C. on a 747 so people could see it. Back to you.
KC2, QIQ.
Craig, Glenn.
Actually, the Russian space shuttle, or the version that never flew, they actually loaded it onto a barge. And floated it down a river into Europe, and actually some European actually wound up buying it and put it into a museum somewhere in Europe. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
No, that thing flew, Glenn.
When you say flew, does that mean it flew on a transport vehicle, or did it fly in space? Back to you, Paul.
It may have flown once, its last trip was floating. K2RNW, KC2QIQ.
When you say it flew, Paul, do you mean it flew on a transport vehicle similar to a 747?
No, it flew. They shot this thing out of space, made two orbits, I think, and then they brought it back and landed. With, you know, autonomously, nobody on board.
So, two orbits, one mission, and landed as radio control. Wow. Boy, if you lose that signal on that radio control, can, you know, a quarter of a million pounds of vehicle coming back down to Earth, can that do damage if it goes in the wrong place? And where did that land, Paul? At Baikonur? Over to you.
I don't remember. Oh, boy, it's been a lot of years since I've looked into that. Don't know if the Baikonur had the runway. I guess Kazakhstan, that's where everything came down. Kazakhstan, they probably brought it down there as well. They had like a dry bed situation. They didn't build like this 3-mile runway that we had in California and Edwards and White Sands and Florida. They landed in a salt bed somewhere. I'll look into it. Yeah, it's a good piece of human space history. But, I think I answered John's question. I hope I did, but to the frame, maybe he meant something else inside the shuttle or something. But, the basic shuttle system won't be able to go into it or anything, from what I understand, at all. The museum, you should just look at it. Back to you, Dick.
One last question, Paul. What, in your opinion, is the total number of space shuttle flights? From the very beginning to the very end. Did the space shuttle altogether fly 150 flights, rough guess? Over to you.
Last mission was what, 135? I believe it was 135 was the final mission. 133. It's either 133 or 135, I forgot, but I think it's somewhere in that area. I think they got to 135.
KC2QIQ with some further information.
Go ahead, Glenn. You'll find out in a minute why I'm asking that question. You got it, Glenn.
Sorry to interrupt, Dick, but I just was looking at a Wikipedia site on this the Buran spacecraft from Russia. And Paul is right. One of them definitely flew. Their shuttle did fly, unmanned. But it actually got destroyed. It was stored in a hangar. And the hangar collapsed and destroyed it. But apparently they made more than one of them. And the one that's in Europe today is actually one of the other ones that they were able to salvage, and it was auctioned off. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That's amazing that a hangar would collapse onto their shuttle. Was that snow loading on that hangar? What do you think, Glenn?
It doesn't say. It's called the Baikonur Kazadrome, and it says it collapsed on it. Yeah, somewhere around 2002. And I guess whatever was left of the other parts or whatever, they took one, and then that one got sold to someone for a museum in Europe. Back to you, this, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Interesting how major programs like that can be started and then stopped. I know that after the Challenger disaster and the Columbia disaster, they did build another space shuttle, which was, I think, the Endeavour. And at that time, one vehicle to build it was $2 billion. That's a lot of money by modern-day standards way back then. So because of the price of the shuttle, because of the risk of the shuttle, because we've already flown 133 or 135 missions with them, it sure does look like that program is really ended. Not going to be returned. The reason I'm curious about the 135 is that each of those shuttle landings, because it is a pure glider, you've got to line up that runway just right. You only get one shot at it. And if you miss that runway because of bad weather or a pilot error or whatever, you don't get a chance to go around again. There's no power on board. So each one of those landings has to be perfectly lined up. You've got to have it at the right altitude, at the right time, at the right latitude and longitude. You've got to make the right turns in the right places. All of that was controlled by something called the microwave scanning beam landing system. MS, let's see, microwave scanning, MSBLS, yeah, MSBLS, which is a piece of hardware built by Airborne Instruments Laboratory, the company I worked for 40 years, let me think, 35 years. Yeah, I retired after 35 years, came out of college, joined this company with a buddy of mine, and the two of us never worked for any other company, retired on the exact same day, started on the exact same day, 35 years later, but that's one of their better successes. So to my knowledge, that system never hiccuped, and 133 or 135 landings hit the mark every single time. Otherwise, you would really hear about it, because, as I said, there's no go-around. If you miss the runway, it's game over. KC2 WGB, go right ahead with your question, John. K2RIW in the tech net.
KC2 WGB. Okay, this is a little long, a little lengthy. I'm going to give you the description of the experiment I'm running, and if you need any fill-ins when we're done, you just ask me, and I'll first let me describe it. I'll let it drop. Okay, I'm working with 100 megacycles. I have an antenna on the bench, an antenna bench. I built a Faraday cage, and I'm trying to understand how a Faraday cage works. Inside the Faraday cage, I have a little coil. One of my sniffers are in there, connected to my analyzer. Okay. Now, there's a probe called a flex probe that has a end connector on one end. A bead of copper tubing, very soft copper, that runs down to the Faraday cage. Wire for the probe is built into that copper pipe. That's where the coil is connected to. Now, that copper pipe can be soldered to the Faraday cage, or it can be isolated with a little sleeve nylon bushing that slides in and out. The Faraday cage is constructed out of copper screening. It's about 10 inches square. What I'm doing is, as I said, trying to understand how the Faraday cage works. Now, I'm running 1 watt out of this at 100 megahertz. I got the description so far. But
I think I do. It's a 10-inch cube that is your Faraday cage. You've got a probe inside. You're going to be testing a 100 megahertz antenna. Is the antenna a dipole-like antenna? What is the actual antenna you're putting in that cage? Back to you, Paul.
I'm just radiating from a small vertical width, approximately 19 inches, maybe 22 inches, I think it is, and that's standing approximately 2 feet from the gauge, 2.5 feet from the gauge, so far.
Okay, up till now, I thought the Faraday cage was going to be shielding the antenna, that it was going to be around the antenna, because the cage is a 10-inch cube, and the antenna is 20 inches long as a whip. Obviously, it's not in the cage. You said it's 2 feet away from the cage, okay? So you got 2 feet away from the cage. You got a whip that's going to be doing some radiating. And I think you're about to measure the shielding capability of your Faraday cage. In other words, you've got sensing devices inside that cage. And 2 feet away, you want to know how much E field or H field or how much signal is getting through the Faraday cage and getting inside when you slam the door, so to speak. That's what I think you're saying. Over to you, Paul. Okay, I'm John, K2RIW, listening.
Yes, Dick, and it's a little difficult for me to discern exactly what's going on. This is really a rough experiment. But now, the sniffer loop is inside the Faraday cage, so I'm trying to detect that signal from within the Faraday cage that goes to my spectrum analyzer. Now, whether I have the nylon sleeve isolating the copper pipe from the Faraday cage or not, it doesn't make any difference whether I connect the pipe directly to the cage, which would ground the cage, or have the bushing in there. Okay. Now, a couple of questions. Operation of the Faraday cage, is it absorbing energy? Are there RF current loops within that matrix, within each little hatch of the Faraday cage? Do we have circulating currents in that? That's my first question.
I'm going to make a guess that your Faraday cage is made out of either copper screening or galvanized quarter-inch hardware cloth, or maybe it's made out of sheet metal.
Copper screen.
Okay, copper screening. I presume all the edges of the copper screening are soldered together, but there's something equivalent to a door on one of the six sides of this 10-inch cube, and when you open that door, you can place objects inside, close the door, and hopefully the door has something equivalent to finger stock around the perimeter of the door, so that when the door is closed, it becomes another completely connected sixth side, side number six of this Faraday cage, so that now the Faraday cage is a truly shielded six-sided box where all the corners are soldered together or thoroughly connected together. Are we, am I getting the right picture of what your Faraday cage looks like so far? And if you might have to do a little bit more description of the Faraday cage. Over to you, John.
I think you got the concept exactly. No door. All I have is a quarter-inch hole where that pipe enters. And like I say, if I solder it to the cage or use a bushing to isolate it, it makes no difference with the reading that I get on the analyzer. So that's it. I position the loop, the little sniffer loop, in the cage, in the center, and then I put the top on the cage and soldered it all the way around so the box is totally conductive throughout.
Out of curiosity, John, how much signal strength are you putting into the 20-inch whip antenna at 100 megacycles? Is that getting a 0 dBm signal, so to speak? Over to you, John.
I'm running 1 watt into that antenna, and I believe it's radiating most of the signal. But whatever it's radiating, it doesn't change. That stays standard.
Okay. You've got a rather severe test, not too difficult from some of the requirements we had on the jamming pods of the EA-6B aircraft. It was called the ALQ-99. There you had a voltage-controlled oscillator, which went through, it had a signal that swept the signal back and forth with a complicated waveform, swept it in frequency, a bunch of amplifiers that eventually went into a transmitter. The transmitter put out a tremendous amount of power, kilowatts of power, into an antenna, where the antenna was, oh, let me pick a number, 2 feet or so away from the chunk of electronics that contained the voltage-controlled oscillator. So a kilowatt signal, it wasn't kilowatt, but it was in that vicinity. A kilowatt signal is plus 60 dBm. The oscillator was running around 0 dBm, so if you didn't have way beyond 60 decibels of shielding, not counting the gain of the antenna, you needed 90 decibels of shielding. The signal coming out of the transmitter and antenna 2 feet away could, by way of the shielding, get coupled back to the input of the circuit, and you get a great big looped oscillator that's different than the control that you're trying to exercise. In your particular case, let me drop. A 1 watt signal is plus 30 dBm. 30 decibels stronger than 1 milliwatt. That's what dBm means. Double shielded coaxial cable, RG9, with properly installed type N connector, on a good day, is good for 90 dB of shielding. Single shielded cable like RG8, RG58, is only good for about 60 decibels of shielding, with, say, a PNC connector or even a type N connector. So the blade of the cables that you're using only have approximately 60 decibels of shielding. Plus 30 dBm is what you're radiating from a very close distance. Therefore, plus 30 dBm through the shielding becomes a minus 30 dBm signal on the inside of your cage just because of the shielding of your cable. So even before you get to the cage, your connectors, the shielding of the box of your spectrum analyzer, there's a zillion other sneak paths by which your signal that you're transmitting can get into your spectrum analyzer circuit. A good spectrum analyzer in the 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth has a sensitivity of minus 85 dBm. And I just gave you a calculated signal of minus 30, 40 some odd dB stronger, if you know what I mean. So you're going to be seeing all kinds of signals that you think are getting into the cage. It could very likely be getting through the shielding of your connectors and your flexible cables. If you are using both braided flexible cables, you'd be amazed how much shielding you were not getting that you thought you were getting. That's the beginning of the problem. There's a lot more going on here yet. KC2 WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
KC2 QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
If I understand the experiment correctly, in which I guess John has an analyzer of some sort on the outside, a piece of cable running into a cage that is either floating and or grounded, and putting the probe in there and hoping for some kind of shielding around the probe. And then, of course, there's an antenna somewhere else inside the room, someplace else, and is looking to see attenuation. I don't think he's going to see much of any attenuation, if maybe 3 dB. And my reasoning there is that unless that analyzer and its cables and everything are inside the Faraday shield or completely inside that shielded area, and the analyzer is being fed through some kind of a feed-through to prevent anything coming in from the other end, basically just having a metal cage around a floating probe basically doesn't attenuate much of anything. So in other words, he would have to establish the ground plane like on an EMI table, where everything is on one plane, the analyzer's inside of it, the probe is inside of it, everything's sitting inside of it, that thing is closed, and now you're viewing the screen of the analyzer through the mesh, and then turn the antenna on, and then I think you'll see attenuation. But just having an open-ended probe sitting inside of a metal box, I don't think you'll see much of any attenuation at all. Back to you, Dick, for comment. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Both you and I are about to be surprised by what John really measured. But on a good day, what I just measured, if he had connectors that were well shielded to that cage, and he thinks the sniffer coil inside is picking up a signal, just the leakage of his cables and connectors with the spectrum analyzer on the outside, and the leakage of the box of the spectrum analyzer itself, I could see 60 decibels of attenuation if things were done just right, a minus 30 dBm signal. Glenn was speculating only 3 dB of attenuation. In other words, with a plus 30 dBm signal, he's predicting you're going to see a plus 27. I don't think you saw something anywhere near that strong, but that's what Glenn was predicting. So on a good day, you could get your signal with your method of measurement down to minus 30 when you're transmitting plus 30 from 2 feet away with a medium well-matched antenna doing real radiating. So as you can tell, John, electromagnetic interference measurements, electromagnetic compatibility, electromagnetic interference, EMI measurements, it's an art and science. And like Glenn is saying, in most cases, all of your instrumentation has to be inside of the screen room with all of the 110-volt wiring to that room going through dirty boxes that have all kinds of bypassing with the equivalent of a filter con, in other words, an inductor, capacitor, pi network, coupling the 60-cycle power into the room, and all of that wiring kept away from the actual sources of signal. So making a screen room is nowhere near as easy as it first would appear. Let me drop for a second. As you've heard me say so often, John, once you generate a radio signal and transmit it into space, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of the universe. That's what radio does. It goes everywhere. Bounces off of everything, flows through everything, goes everywhere. The only thing left to discuss is how strong is the signal at the place where you're measuring, how sensitive is your instrumentation. That's the only thing that determines whether or not the signal is above threshold of your instrumentation. But if you've got sensitive enough instrumentation, a long enough integration time, no matter how well shielded, no matter how long your distance, you will always measure that signal that was transmitted into space. You can never completely kill it. You can lower it by X number of dB. In your particular case, I'm going to guess the best you would get is 60 dB of attenuation. Glenn thinks only 3, and what you probably measured is somewhere in between. John's about to tell us what he measured. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Oh no, it gets worse. Okay, what I did was I disconnected the probe to the analyzer, and I put the cap on the input of the end connector to the spectrum analyzer. Just how much I could pick up the body of the spectrum analyzer. Okay, and let's put a signal in there. Let's say I was picking up 10 dB when I would turn the oscillator on. Now, don't forget, when the probe is attached, the probe wiring, not only double shielded, double braid, it's inside a copper pipe, a tubing. And that tubing can be either soldered to the cage or not. Also, when I make the measurement and I remove the plug-in sniffer coil, I can see it drop down. All right. So I know I am picking up some signal. But the whole idea of this experiment is to learn how a Faraday cage works. What I'm trying to do is now, after that is built, I want to know what is the reflection at 100 megacycles, if any. Is it being absorbed into the copper? And does it have circulating currents? These are my original questions. The shielding, I understand the radiation, and all of my AC lines are decoupled and tunable to knock out maximum, as much as I can of any RF. Now, the idea was to sort of have like a piece of paper over this with iron filing so I could map the radiation pattern, where it's being absorbed, and where it is being limited. So there's more questions if it is. So how about, are you up to date now? Any more questions?
Hey, John, you're doing a very interesting science experiment that's going to be very educational, and it's going to be a humbling experience. You gave me an ambiguous answer. You said you measured a signal of 10 dB. Now, does that mean 10 dB weaker? Does that mean plus 10 dBm? Does that mean minus 10 dBm? You just had to tell me you measured a signal of 10 dB. Was that positive or negative dBm? Or was that 10 dB of isolation? What are the plus? What are the 10 dB of signal measure? You're eventually going to answer your question, but there's a couple of ambiguities here first. Go ahead, John.
Okay, when I turned the oscillator on, I would measure 10 dB above the noise floor.
Okay. What was the resolution bandwidth and how far were you sweeping with the spectrum analyzer? If, for instance, you were using a 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth, a modern-day non-preamplified spectrum analyzer has a noise floor of approximately minus 85 dBm if it's a 1 meg resolution bandwidth. If you used a 1 kilohertz resolution bandwidth, it would be minus 105 dBm of average noise power. What was the res bandwidth? How far were you sweeping? And I'm presuming the signal you were transmitting was unmodulated CW carrier is my guess. Over to you, John.
That's correct, Dick. Unmodulated. Okay. I was using 100 kilohertz in bandwidth.
Okay, if your particular spectrum analyzer did not have any RF attenuation dialed in, almost all spectrum analyzers, in order to protect the front end, they wake up with 10 dB of RF attenuation automatically dialed in the front end. So if that's true, with 100 kilohertz res bandwidth, the spectrum analyzer would have a threshold of minus 85. If you could override that wake-up procedure and force the RF attenuation on the front end of the spectrum analyzer to go to 0 dB, then the noise would be at a signal level of minus 95 dBm per 100 kilohertz. Do you remember roughly what the calibrated noise power on the spectrum analyzer was? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, mine does not have that feature. I had it set for 0 dBm.
I think you're saying you set the vertical scale such that the top of the screen is 0 dBm. If it was a 100 decibel screen, then the bottom of the screen would be at minus 100. And my guess is your noise power was somewhere in the vicinity of 3 boxes above the bottom of the screen. Is that roughly true, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, about that. Maybe 2. Could have been 2 or 3. Don't have exact measurements, because I was working on another understanding. But, yeah, I would say we could go with 3.
What's your best guess as to where the RF attenuator on the spectrum analyzer was set? Was it set at 0, 10, or 20 decibels of RF attenuation? Over to you, John.
I was set at 0.
Okay. If your spectrum analyzer does not have a preamplifier that you can dial in, if it has 0 dB on the RF attenuation, and your res bandwidth is 100 KC, and if the analyzer is up to full specifications, your average noise power should have been minus 95. Yeah, two boxes up, roughly minus 95, average with peaks at around two boxes up. And now you saw the signal 10 dB above that, which is around minus 70. So you saw a signal in the vicinity of minus 70 when you're transmitting plus 30. Wow. That is a power spread of, minus 70 to plus 30. That's almost 100 dB. You are getting 100 decibels of power spread. Like you said, you had good connectors, double-shielded cable. The cable itself, double-shielded, is only good for 90. You are getting 100 decibels of isolation. You are getting way beyond what Glenn thought you were getting. You are doing considerably better than what I thought. You got quality connectors, well-installed, double-shielded cable. That's the best you could pray for, John. You are getting all you were entitled to even before. Now, here's the problem. Let me drop. Even if your connector is now, your copper pipe that your double-shielded coax cable is going through, and that copper pipe is soldered down to your 10-inch cube Faraday cage, and the cable itself, we'll assume by some magic, is well connected to that copper pipe. And that in itself is a whole art and science as to how you do that. But assuming you've done that. Now, the signal that's coming from your antenna, walking through the shielded box of your spectrum analyzer, is one of the sneak paths. Another one of the sneak paths is through the type N connectors themselves. They're only good for a guaranteed 90 and maybe 100 dB on a good day. And you are getting 100 dB. So the shielding of the double-shielded cable, the shielding of the type N connector, the shield of the box of the spectrum analyzer, all three of those were letting through sneak signals. The shielding of the Faraday cage is letting through a sneak signal. You've got a total of four signals going into that spectrum analyzer. They're all coming from the same antenna, but those four individual signals are beating against each other as a vector summing device, depending on how much is picked up during what length of the cable, and how much is picked up by the type N connector leakage, how much is picked up by the copper pipe and its connection to the Faraday shield leakage, because you had four sources of signal being vector summed to finally get into the display of the spectrum analyzer. Now, as you tuned and detuned that tuned circuit, that sniffer coil inside the Faraday cage, you would like the signal go up and down in a characteristic manner, and I predict it did not. Let me drop. Because you had four sources of signals, and you were fiddling with one of the four sources, which means you were either adding or subtracting in phase or out of phase or in quadrature, the signal being picked up by your sniffer coil, your probe, versus the other three sources of signals. My guess is as you fiddle with that probe, the signal changed in amplitude in mysterious ways, to which you said, what in the blank is going on here? I wonder if that's one of the words that was said on Etting Street in the last week. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, if the expletives are deleted, I have nothing to say. But, okay, so now it gets a little uglier. Now, as I was working with this cube, I rotated it, a plan view from the top, clockwise, 10 degrees, 20 degrees, then back, and then in the other direction. There was some indication of change on the analyzer, but not much. But again, back to my original question, what is happening with the Faraday cage? Does the copper screening have currents induced in it? And how are they traveling around the matrix within the hatch area, or are they traveling in loops equivalent to a full wave or quarter wave? And then I have something even more disturbing to tell you after this. Maybe you could give me a clue on what's happening with the actual current, that RF current. I know it's not being reflected, not much of it, But if it's being absorbed, it has to be inducing currents in the Faraday screen. It's soon.
Hey, Vic and John, what was the signal if you took the probe, just took it out of the Faraday cage, and just left it in the air the same distance away from the antenna?
Didn't make that measurement. It's very difficult to open this and put it back in. It was very difficult, but I will get to that too at the same distance and measure the amount the sniffer picks up. That's a good point that I didn't cover.
Did you check to see if you, when you open and close the door, whether there was any difference?
Well, it's not a door. When I take the cover off, I wouldn't even turn the transmitter on because I can't take that risk with my spectrum analyzer set at 0 dB.
How far away is the antenna?
It's 2 feet from the coil, maybe 2.5 feet.
Taxi to KTRIW, KC2QIQ.
I just made a beautiful transmission into the wrong mic, but I could immediately hear that I wasn't transmitting. How long was the coaxial cable coming out of the front end of the spectrum analyzer, going into the copper pipe and then into your Faraday cage? How long was that coaxial cable, John?
The copper tubing is 36 inches, and the cable sticks out, I would say, maybe 2 inches beyond that, so 38 inches.
Wow. So you've got a piece of copper pipe going into this 10-inch cube Faraday cage, and the copper pipe is 36 inches long, and then the double shielded coax cable, a couple of inches of it comes out of the tail end of that 36 inch copper pipe and gets screwed into the front of the spectrum analyzer. Is that the picture?
Negative, Dick. This is a very special probe. It has an end connector on it which contains the double shielded wire. There is a fixed piece of copper tubing that's permanently connected at the end connector. It's welded right on there. The only opening is where it goes into the cage. The wire hangs out about 2 inches, maybe 1.5 inches, where it connects to the sniffer probe.
If I've got a type N connector welded on the back end of a piece of 36-inch long copper tubing, I'm going to guess that copper tubing is in the vicinity of quarter inch to a half inch, in diameter. If I've got 36 inches of copper tubing hanging off a type N connector, screwed down to my type N connector on the front end of a spectrum analyzer, that's a very long cantilever. If you don't make that connector very carefully, you can easily cross-thread that connection. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's 5/32. You're right. It's shaped, it comes out from the front of the spectrum analyzer on that end connector, comes about, I would say, 4 inches directly out at you. Then it makes its 90, goes down to the bench, and then you can flex it from there over to what you're doing. But you do have to be very careful in threading that on there. It's sort of rigid, especially after you flex it a couple of times, as you know with copper.
Is this a piece of semi-rigid copper, 5/8 inch? Now, at first it sounded like a solid piece of 3 foot long, 36 inch copper tubing, with a type N connector welded onto the end. It was one of the descriptions. Now, by some magic, it comes out of the connector of the spectrum analyzer, bends down to the desk, and then goes over. Does that make it, it makes a Z bend? Does the copper tubing make a Z bend in the process of going over to your Faraday cage? Over to you, John.
No, Dick. After it makes the 4-inch transition toward you, plunges down to the bench and forms an L and goes to the left to the Faraday cage. There's only that 190. Then if you go up to the top, there's another 90 where it returns to the spectrum analyzer.
Is each one of those 90 a elbow connector of some kind?
Negative. This is solid copper tubing.
So the solid copper tubing has two 90-degree bends. A few inches off of the spectrum analyzer, it makes a 90-degree bend down to the bench. As it approaches the bends, it makes another 90-degree bend over to the Faraday cage, and the rest of the pipe is parallel to the bench. Is that true?
That's correct.
So therefore, in that environment, you don't have very much flexibility to move around the Faraday cage. You can't take the Faraday cage and pick it up a foot or move it left and right a foot In other words, that Faraday cage is pretty much rigid in its location based on that copper tubing that you don't want to bend a whole lot of times and fatigue it. Is that approximately right?
That's very true, Dick. I could change it a few degrees, like I was saying, the top view, it would be a few degrees to the right, a few degrees to the left, clockwise and counterclockwise. I could also lift it up and probably lower it because there's enough flexibility to do that, but you don't have much much room to move it.
The 1 watt transmitter is located where? Is it sitting on top or way off to the left or to the right of the spectrum analyzer? Does it have a piece of double shielded RG9 light cable, RG214, double shielded coax cable going over to it with antenna? So where is it? How long is that cable? How much freedom do you have to move the WIP antenna? Over to you, John.
The WIP antenna is connected to a piece of double shielded RG90, I think it is, that goes to the generator. The generator is approximately, I'd say, 6 feet away from where I'm working. Maybe four.
Okay, so you've got some good physical separation between the signal generator and the spectrum analyzer. Some number of feet of flexible double-shielded cable goes to that antenna, and the antenna ends up 2 feet away from the Faraday cage, which is on a 3-foot-long piece of copper tubing. And so you can change the orientation of the Faraday cage when it is or isn't soldered down. You've got an unusual circumstance here, but I'm pretty sure there are 4 ingress points. Each of the type N connectors has got a certain amount of shielding. The copper tubing, as good as it is, it's got a lot of shielding, at least 100 dB. That's the best part of the system. The Faraday cage itself has got a problem, John. When you're at 100 megahertz, which is 3 meters, a piece of waveguide that's not beyond cutoff, that a signal can propagate down the waveguide, must be 1/4 of a wavelength, correction, 1/2. It's got to be 1/2 of a wavelength in major dimension, otherwise the signal doesn't go down there. 1/2 wavelength is 1.5 meters, unless your Faraday cage is 1.5 meters in one of its 3 dimensions. And the Faraday cage is, by definition, a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff, in which case, even if one face of the Faraday cage was completely open-circuited, an amazingly small amount of signal would get into that 5-sided box, if you know what I mean, because it's waveguide beyond cutoff. It is not 1.5 meters wide. It is, as you go down into that box, every inch is going to give you a large number of dB of shielding if you had a thoroughly independent floating detector inside of that box running on a battery. You'd be amazed how much shielding you're going to get from that box. Now, the original question you asked, which, as you can tell, we're resisting.
Dick, can I add one more statement here?
Go ahead, Glenn. As you can tell, Glenn and I are really not answering your question directly for a whole bunch of reasons, because there's a bunch of other funny things going on here. But go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
Did I not hear that the signal going into the antenna is plus 30 dBm, and that the analyzer is measuring plus 10 dBm? And it's 2 feet away inside a copper box, so that's 20 dB of attenuation at best? Or did I hear something wrong? Case 2, QIQ.
You definitely heard something wrong. John told us that the signal is 10 decibels above the noise floor of the spectrum analyzer. And I say the noise floor of the spectrum analyzer is in the vicinity of minus 80 dBm. The top of the screen is 0 dBm. The bottom of the screen is minus 100. His noise is around 2 boxes up from the bottom of the screen. So his noise is in the vicinity of minus 80, and the signal is approximately 10 dB above that noise floor. That makes the signal in the vicinity of minus 70. So he's got minus 70 of signal, 2 feet away, so to speak, from plus 30 dBm coming out of the antenna. He is getting 100 decibels of shielding. Ain't that amazing, Glenn? Over to you, Glenn, for that one first.
Yeah, that's a lot more than I would expect, for sure. Just a question for you, John. Can you verify that? In other words, you were only measuring minus 70 dBm on your analyzer?
Yes, exactly as Dick described it.
That's pretty good.
And if he wanted to be a double darn sure, he could take one of his calibrated signal generators, and he's a guy that likes getting them calibrated. He could set the dial on the front panel for a signal strength of minus 70. He could pour it straight into that spectrum analyzer, and I guarantee he's going to see a signal in the vicinity of 10 dB above the noise floor of that spectrum analyzer. He doesn't have to do that, but if he did do that, I think that's what he would see. I'm back to you for a confirmation on that one, John.
That's a good test to run also. I could also do that. But I know my spectrum analyzer is definitely in calibration. But that's another thing. I could run the Gigatronics into that also, because I'm using the other Gigatronics for the sampling signal. Ready to take this? I'm sorry I'm taking so much time with this, but I'm very interested in this. Ready for a further rendition of this?
Oh, this is an extremely good experiment, John, which proves a whole lot of things all at once. For a person who's hearing the details of all this, there's a huge learning curve here. What is the real amount of shielding of the case of a spectrum analyzer? What's the real amount of shielding of a properly installed, properly tightened down, torqued type N connector? What's the real amount of shielding of single braid and double shield flexible coax cable? How much signal gets picked up by a probe? How much shielding do you get from a so-called Faraday shield that even if it wasn't shielded, it is a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff because of its dimensions? Its biggest dimension is way small compared to 1.5 meters.
I have a question about that, Dick, if you don't mind.
We're going to get this. It's way small compared to 1.5 meters of half wavelength in order to propagate a signal into your Faraday shield. Now, if I've got a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff, a piece of X-band waveguide, we'll say, or L-band waveguide, and you're putting a 100 megacycle signal on the outside, and I go down inside of that waveguide, let me pick a number, 3, 4, 5 inches, and put some kind of a completely floating, battery-operated detecting device inside of that waveguide, and I make E-field measurements and H-field measurements. There's a whole bunch of difficulty in doing what I just described, but that would be the purest thing you could do. And as you move that signal, you take a wooden stick and you take that detecting device, completely floating, battery-operated detecting device, and you push it with the wooden stick another inch down inside the waveguide, that's waveguide beyond cutoff. You would be doing an experiment exactly like the piston attenuator that you got on the front end of a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator. Every inch is going to give you, let me pick a number, 30 decibels of shielding, if you know what I mean, once you've got waveguide beyond cutoff. It happens real fast, and it's a thoroughly calibrated system. That's how that piston attenuator works on the spectrum analyzer, on the Hewlett-Packard 608. Very, very reproducible, very predictable, very traceable to the Bureau. Every millimeter gives you an exact number of decibels of decrease in signal strength as that detecting device, that piston, gets retracted out the back end of that piston attenuator of the 608. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the SECNAT.
10-6, and waiting for this question.
Okay, now, from what you're saying, I may have interpreted it wrong, but now what if I were to take my grid meter, the little one that I have, dial in the frequency, the top off of the cage, slowly lower it down. When I get to the point where the waveguide beyond cutoff effect takes place, I should have no signal on that grid meter. Is that true? Even with the cover removed?
Not at all. Your 100 megacycle coil on the grid meter, in the case of the Heathkit grid dip meter, the coil that goes to 150 megacycles, is a U-shaped chunk of silver-plated brass, about an inch and a half high, maybe about three-quarters of an inch wide. That's the two tangs that plug into the socket of the grid dipper. The way you get the coil of the grid dip meter into the box means that there is an extension of that coil coming out of the box.
No, I can put the whole grid meter in this box.
You're telling me the whole head of the grid tip meter will fit inside of a 10-inch cube box. However, the wire coming out of the head goes into the rest of the instrument that's got the power supply, the meter that deflects and tells you how strong is the grid tip and so on. That wire, the amount of...
No, I have to explain it to you, Dick.
Okay. Are you telling me you've got a thoroughly battery-operated, completely floating grid tip meter inside of that Faraday shield? Go ahead.
Yes, I do. My Heathkit 1250 will fit inside that cage, and it is a coil that plugs in. It's not just a loop. That's what's on the measurements unit. Yeah, I mean, the Heathkit is really, you know, it's a piece of junk, but it will detect that signal. So now, if I lower the entire unit in, will I see that effect?
Tell me the dimensions of your grid dip meter that's battery operated. What is its dimensions? How close is it coming to the edge of the box? Were you lowering it such that the coil was parallel to the bottom portion of the Faraday cage, that's parallel to the shelf? There's a whole lot of variables here. Describe its sizes and the way you lowered it. Was it being lowered on a piece of rope, if you know what I mean? Go ahead.
I didn't do it, Dick, but from your suggestion, I was going to try that. It's only about total length, maybe 6 inches by 2 by 2, 2 inches by 2 inches by maybe 6, 6.5 inches. So that'll fit right in that box.
So you first hold the grid dip meter as far away from the antenna as you can, where you're still getting a power indication. You're now using it as a tunable detector, not as a grid dip meter. And you set it to the right frequency. And as you set it to the right frequency, hopefully the coil doesn't come too close to the side of the box where it gets detuned. You've got it on a piece of dial cord, a piece of a lacing cord, and now you slowly lower it into that box. And you will see the indication decrease very rapidly as it goes down to the bottom of that box, John. And you're going to be putting it down there parallel to the bottom. The box itself is waveguide beyond cutoff. You've got no other probe. You've just got the box is a five-sided thing. The top surface you've got completely removed, open, and the other five sides of this 10-inch box are there. And 2 feet away, you've got this 100 megacycle signal coming out of a whip antenna. As you lower that tunnel detector into that box, you're going to see that signal fall off quite fast. And I think it is likely that you'll have trouble detecting the presence of the signal when the tunnel dipper is in the bottom of that box. Over to you, John.
This one's not the tunnel dipper. It's a model after that. It's a much smaller model, and it works fairly well. Okay, I never thought of trying that, but this is getting to what I was trying to find out, the question that you're not answering, not a Faraday cage, but also I made a field measurement around the bench with my field strength meter and found areas like in back of the box where the signal would drop drastically. And if I would raise it a little bit, it would just raise a little bit until I cleared the box. The question is that because it's blocking the signal or absorbing the signal? Or is it doing both? And that's what I'm trying to understand about the Faraday cage, which you're not answering.
Yeah, John and I are not, I mean, Glenn and I are not giving you a direct answer yet, because there's a whole lot of variables involved here. First of all, your Faraday cage made out of copper screening has no loss mechanism. It's a highly conducting chunk of copper, the copper screening, the solder. There's no loss, there's no resistance anywhere. You could put your ohm meter, your milli-ohm meter, your micro-ohm meter, across the diagonal corners of your Faraday shield, and you're going to measure milli-ohms or micro-ohms. There's no real resistance there. So it cannot absorb, but it can do a tremendous amount of shielding. Now, your probe that's picking up the signal, there's a zillion ways you could build that probe. One way would be a calibratable sniffer, which is a piece of semi-rigid cable where the center conductor of the semi-rigid cable with its polyethylene shielding on it is formed into a 360-degree loop and the end of that loop reconnects to the shield of the semi-rigid wave oven into a detecting device like a spectrum analyzer and measure whether or not any leakage is happening over each individual linear inch of the door of your microwave oven. So that kind of a sniffer would be very valuable. As you make the sniffer bigger and bigger at 100 megacycles, it now starts developing an antenna pattern that's a little bit different than the one of the loop that I'm describing, the H-field loop, and life gets a little bit more complicated. So what was the nature of your detecting device that you used? I presume it was on a piece of flexible cable. Over to you, John.
Antenna Jane is waiting for the time.
KC2WGB. All right, at the end of the cable, I have, at the end of the spectrum analyzer cable, there's a coil of about 5 turns of number 30 wire, and it's soldered directly from shield to the center conductor. That's the sniffer loop that I'm using. Yeah, that totally describes that, and it's vertically polarized, standing like a coin on edge.
Oh, there's a lot of ambiguity here. 5 turns of 30 gauge wire. Is it wound like a pancake, or is it wound like a solenoid? What diameter? How long? Give me some words on that coil.
Okay, it's 1.25 in diameter, and it's wound as a pancake coil, and the leads coming to the shielded coax are only about 1/4 inch long off the coil itself.
What made you decide to use 5 turns, John, instead of 1 turn?
First of all, it's a coil I had. I didn't make one specially for that, and I thought I could get a little more gain that way, a little more sensitivity with more turns at that frequency.
Okay, now know that the 5 turns are 1.25 inches in diameter. What is the height of that coil? You called it a pancake coil. Is it 1/8 inch high?
You mean the thickness of the winding?
The 5 turns. If the 5 turns were wound in a solenoid-like manner, what's the length of that solenoid?
Oh, I would say 1/8 inch.
So the 5 turns are enameled wire essentially touching each other and all glued together. Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, what you described is primarily an H-field probe, and it doesn't have to be 5 turns. It could have been 1 turn. Typically, when people make a sniffer, they always make it as 1 single turn. Very few people will make it as 5 turns. But and that makes life a little bit more difficult. But that is primarily an H-field probe, an untuned H-field probe. Have you done any kind of network analyzer sweeping of that coil to see if it has any resonance anywhere near 100 megacycles? John, go ahead.
Resonates at 73. We've got a good spike at 73.
Oh, so when you put it on a network analyzer, it gives you a spike at 73. Does that mean when you're measuring voltage reflection coefficient, S11, you get a flat curve of near 0 dB that makes a nosedive at 73? It's got a vertical going spike down at 73 that beyond 73 comes back up to be level with the top of the screen again. Go ahead.
No, I didn't use a network analyzer for that. I used my generator and my oscilloscope to see the sensitivity and where I could have valleys in that waveform. And at 73, this thing couples up tremendously.
Okay, the spectrum analyzer is connected to the coil, and you're sweeping a signal, what, through that whip antenna to find out where the coil will respond? Is that what you were doing?
No, I tested the coil independently. The antenna signal is steady at 100 megahertz. That does not sweep.
Okay. Where was the source of signal? Where was the detector when you were testing the coil?
I took that coil. That was hooked up to my oscilloscope. And I had a sweeping signal generator that would run, and it was a proximity near field, I would say, 6 inches away. There was a transmitting loop, and that as a receiving loop.
Are you saying you had a pair of identical loops, you put them close to each other, one was a sweeping signal generator, one was a spectrum analyzer, is that what you said?
It was an oscilloscope, the detector.
Okay, so as you swept through 73, you saw a great big response on the oscilloscope, and essentially